And because it's Friday, let's turn now to our week in review and talk about the story we've just been talking about, as well as the other week's big local stories. And to help us do that, we're joined by Renee Graham. She's a columnist for the Boston Globe. Renee, it's always a pleasure to see you here. Thanks for coming in.
Good to see you, Anthony.
And Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. Hi, Tom. Good to have you.
Pleasure to be here.
So, sad story that we need to start with. Tarantino was gunned down, allegedly by 34-year-old Jorge Zambrano last weekend after what at first appeared to be a routine traffic stop. And let me just ask both of you, I've got some thoughts about sort of the issues that this story raised, but I'll start with you, Tom. You know, what are you thinking about when we think about this story?
So the assailant here was not a stranger, as they say, to the police or to the courts. He had an enormously long record. He had been picked up a number of times very recently. He'd served time in prison. It was pretty evident that he was a dangerous person. And I think the question that is raised and deserves a fair hearing is whether or not there should have been a way in advance to know that he shouldn't be on the streets. I wouldn't jump to the conclusion and say that somehow the system failed, because I don't know if it failed.
Right.
I mean, we can't.
It's worth raising the question.
In hindsight, we always have perfect views, right? But we don't know. And yet there are enough questions here that it deserves a real inquisition on it.
Yeah. Renee, what's your view on this?
You know, I understand the way people are reacting emotionally to this, you know, because an officer was killed in the line of duty. But legally, it seems that he had served his time. He was released from a 7-year prison sentence in 2013. He's gotten in lots of trouble since then, but it seems like there was nothing serious enough to send him back to jail. And I'm not aware that he was on parole so that he could have somehow violated his parole and gone back to jail. It seems like people want to blame the system or say the system failed, but this is just the way the system happens to work.
Hmm. Well, let's listen to Governor Charlie Baker. He talked about this on Boston Herald Radio this week, and he said, sort of echoing some of the points you made there, Tom, that there were a number of ongoing investigations into what happened, and he raised the question about why Zambrano more wasn't done to possibly have stopped Zambrano before he killed. Here's what he said.
We should make adjustments if we need to, especially with respect to how this guy, despite his rap sheet and everything else, managed to be sort of slapped on the wrist and had his last two trips to court continued without a finding, which is just odd.
So we should make adjustments. I'm not sure what those would be, Tom.
I don't know what the adjustments are either. I mean, Renee is right in that, you know, the way the system worked is the way the system works. The question is, given the history here, should bail have been reduced, for example, and one of the times he appeared before a judge?
Yeah.
But with that, it's hard to say what's going on in this guy's mind, and you have to be careful about the fact that if you make the change for people like him, you also, of course, make a change for a lot of people who wouldn't be doing anything as horrendous as shooting a cop.
I mean, you have to remember, a rap sheet isn't a crystal ball.
Right.
You know, it says what has happened. It doesn't predict what's going to occur. And, you know, yes, he'd had, you know, run-ins with the law, and he'd had, you know, assault and battery charges, you know, where he'd assaulted police officers. But I still don't know that would have allowed people to make the leap that this is someone who's someday going to murder a police officer.
It's a tragic story. You know, I was struck this week about what Kevin Cullen in the Boston Globe, he wrote a piece about what he called death's door, about the potential danger that cops face every time they approach a car during a traffic stop. I mean, most of them are routine. In most cases, nothing bad happens. But that that possibility is always there. And Cullen makes the point that so many cops have to sort of take this duty on. And we forget about it. We forget about the peril that could be lurking behind those car doors. I was very struck by that.
Agreed.
Well, let's move on to a different kind of story, another police story, this one in Boston's Back Bay. It issued questions about whether an off-duty Boston police officer used excessive force during a confrontation and eventual arrest with a pedestrian. Now, according to the police report, the man was crossing against a green light, struck the officer's car with his umbrella as it passed too close to him. And part of the confrontation was caught on video by a witness named Stephen Harlow. It shows the officer kneeling on the man, forcing his head into the ground, and then arresting him. Witnesses, including Harlow, were shocked by what they saw. Here's just a portion, some of the audio from the video that he shot.
Crack my window, he's under arrest.
That's a smudge. It's not a crack. And you cut him off.
Were you there?
If he was in the crosswalk, you should have yielded to him.
So mind your business.
No, I'm taping it.
Tape whatever you want.
I will.
So the allegation by the police officer was that he had cracked the window. The window didn't appear to be cracked. There's a lot going on in the 7-plus-minute video. We didn't see what happened before the officer basically had his knee in the middle of his back. But it is a sort of alarming video to look at this point. Renee, what do you see when you look at that video?
I think what's remarkable to me about the video is the fact that it exists at all. And the fact that if not for that video, we wouldn't be having this conversation. This would have just been a situation where a police officer would have been, you know, this pedestrian's word against police officers. And in that circumstance, they're usually going to believe the police officer. So the video is really important. And you do see this moment of this officer on top of this man with his knee in his back and the man's face pressed into the concrete. And you're starting to wonder, like, what exactly happened? And then when you hear the story of, well, I was in the crosswalk and I hit the car with my umbrella and the cop gets, I'm thinking, really? Like, this is what's necessary? Mm. And what I find amazing is the fact that in this day and age, when everyone has a camera phone, that officers will still behave in this manner. Not all officers, I get it, but the fact that there are officers who still somehow think that this behavior is acceptable, and it's not.
Yeah. Tom Keene?
What is really appalling me right now, aside from the video, is the city's response to it. Mm. Mayor Marty Walsh says, oh, we're going to look into it. The guy has not been suspended or anything. The officer in question has not been suspended. In his press conference, Walsh actually chastised the pedestrian for crossing the street and then daring to smack the car with, you know, and give it a little smudge. Something, by the way, I have done before when I've been cut off, and many of us, I bet, have
done. See, Tom, I'm glad you brought this up because this is the thing that alarms me about this story. We've all been in this situation. You're in a crosswalk,
right,
whether or not you've pushed the light or not, and a car almost kills you. And in that moment, you put out your arm and say, hey,
right. And then
I'm
what
walking
Walsh,
here.
Right. And then what Walsh does is he chastises the pedestrian for doing it, but doesn't, by the way, then go and say, oh, but actually, maybe what I should do is chastise the motorist who responds by jumping out and smashing someone's face to the ground.
After chasing him for a block.
After chasing him.
And let's not forget, we're also talking about an officer who has been called on excessive force in the past. That came out, you know, a few days later. So, you know, we're not exactly talking about someone who was just kind of minding his business and going about his day. This might be someone who has a problem. And as Tom has mentioned, the mayor goes after the pedestrian.
Well, we spoke to the mayor about this yesterday. And in fairness, I mean, he prefaced what he told us. He was reluctant to say too much about it while an investigation is underway. But he did say this.
The one thing I will say, the gentleman in the crosswalk, I mean, you can't be hitting people's cars, whether it's a police officer's car or not a police officer's car, with an umbrella. That's something you can't do. But again, this is under review right now.
So, I mean,
exactly.
The exact point you were making, Tom. I mean, you know, I'll take the mayor's point that this is still under investigation. I don't think we know everything. But, you know, this point gets made again and again when we talk about police response and whether or not it was excessive. I mean, you've got two people here. Maybe the pedestrian shouldn't have responded that way, but police are trained, they're paid not to overreact. And, you know, I just think that that's one of the questions that will be answered.
You know, all people want are for the officers to do their job properly.
Yeah.
And when you see something like this, you start to wonder about the training and about the attitude some of these officers may have.
Yeah. What does this say about the push for body cameras? This was an off-duty police officer, so I'm not sure the question about body cameras even comes up here.
I think maybe pedestrians now need to wear them.
Well, in fact,
we do.
As it turns out, we that was sort of the case here. Okay, well, let's move on. Let's shift gear and talk a little about politics because there's a lot going on the campaign trail. Of course, Donald Trump became the presumptive Republican nominee after winning the support of the needed number of delegates. But I want to talk a little bit about Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. This week, she continued her sort of attack dog role, her war of words with Trump. Here's how she summed up Trump at a political gala in Washington, D.C. Tuesday night.
A small, insecure money grubber who doesn't care who gets hurt so long as he makes a profit off it. What kind of a man does that? A man who will never be president of the United States.
Now, Trump is just too eager, is happy to take on Elizabeth Warren. So here he is calling Massachusetts senior senator goofy.
You know, she's got this goofy friend named Elizabeth Warren. She's on her Twitter rant.
She's a goofus. She is a goofus. So, Elizabeth, you ever see her? I mean, this woman, she's a basket case. Did you ever hear of Pocahontas? Huh? It's Pocahontas, Elizabeth Warren.
And, of course, that's a reference to the flap that came up between Elizabeth Warren and Senator Scott Brown when questions were raised about Elizabeth Warren's claims of Indian ancestry. But, Renee, is it good for the Democrats to have Warren as sort of the attack dog in chief?
Oh, I think it's fantastic for the Democrats. She's hitting him in speeches. She's going to, you know, getting into these Twitter fights. And the bottom line is that all Donald Trump can come up with are these sort of kindergarten insults. She's goofy. She's a goofus. But she's hitting him. You know, Donald Trump is easy to get because he's so thin-skinned. So I think this is exactly what Elizabeth Warren should be doing. I love that she's taken on this role. And she's really igniting the Democrats at a time when they really need that.
Mm. Well, let me sort of push back with another idea that getting down in the sort of Donald Trump kind of mud never works. The Republicans tried it. It didn't work.
I don't think she's getting in the mud. I mean, I know there's the old expression, if you, you know, have a fight with a pig in the mud, you get dirty and the pig really likes it. But I don't think she's getting in the mud. I think what she's doing is just hitting him on his policies, on the things he has said, and just the person he is and the way he presents himself. She's undermining every way that he's trying to portray himself. So I don't think she's getting in the mud at all. If she was calling him names, then she would be. She's not doing that.
So I'm going to disagree, because small, insecure money grubber is calling names.
Is that inaccurate,
it's
though?
Size. I don't know. I don't know how tall the guy is, and I don't know what the other reference would be. But I do know that small is definitely pejorative in this case, and money grubber is definitely a pejorative way. And it certainly has nothing to do with policy. I think what she's doing, and I think it's very intentional on the part of the Democrats, they've decided that what they need to do is fight dirty in the same way that Donald Trump fights dirty. And Elizabeth Warren is very good at being blunt and assuming this attack dog mode. I'm not sure if it works, but I think they feel that Hillary Clinton standing above the fray as she has been is just seeming to hurt her, and that she needs to push back. And Elizabeth Warren's a good person to push.
But I think when you have the audio that was, you know, that came out a week or so ago of Donald Trump talking about the 2008 housing crisis and how he was going to benefit from that and how it would be great for people like him, yeah, I think calling him a money grubber is perfectly all right. Hmm. He essentially called himself that. So.
And I'm not saying he isn't. Right. I'm just saying that's the kind of language that's insult language. Yeah. And that's what's going on here. We are in the mud.
Has he gotten racist? Has he, no. But I mean, and I don't think Elizabeth Warren's going to do that. I like what she's doing right now. She's hitting Donald Trump where it hurts.
You know, interesting, sticking with Elizabeth Warren for a while, one of the challenges that we have had here at WBUR, it's actually one shared by a lot of journalists, she doesn't make herself available. She's not easy to get a hold of for journalists like us to talk to. Ailsa Chang did a really interesting piece for NPR this week and sort of made the point that even there in Washington and sort of chasing Elizabeth Warren around Capitol Hill, she had lots of sort of ways from avoiding talking to Ailsa Chang and any other reporter who approached her. But Ailsa Chang spoke to Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid about Warren's role as a sort of party messenger. Here's what Reid said.
What makes her such an effective messenger? Is it the content of her ideas, or is there something about her style?
An effective messenger because, number one, she doesn't talk very much. But when she talks, people listen.
So she doesn't talk very much to people like us. But what about this idea, Tom, of her as an effective messenger because she doesn't talk very much?
Well, she is a hero to many across the country. You know, the interesting question about Elizabeth Warren, I certainly do think that she'll sway voters in Massachusetts, obviously. The question is, who needs to be swayed to support Hillary Clinton in this general election? Mm-hmm. And is Elizabeth Warren going to be the person who does that? And, you know, what it comes down to, of course, is the people in the center. And I don't know whether her words move them towards the Democrats or actually push them away.
That's a really interesting question. What do you think, Renee? Because Elizabeth Warren might be seen as, the political progressive from hyper blue state Massachusetts, preaching to the choir.
I mean, you know, people wanted her to run for president, you know, and she obviously decided not to do that. I think what Elizabeth Warren will do, and as I mentioned earlier, she's going to energize the Democrats in a way that maybe they haven't been so far. And I think, you know, that's what you do. You play to your base, your real base, in a powerful and strong way. And I think that's really going to be helpful for Hillary Clinton or, excuse me, whoever the nominee is going to be. But I think that's going to be very helpful because it gets people on board. It lets people hear messages that they want to hear. you know, I don't know that they're getting that any other place right now, really, in a way that's as compelling as what Elizabeth Warren's been doing.
All right, let's talk quickly about another politician with deep Massachusetts roots who's trying to have an impact on this election. This weekend, former Governor Bill Weld will be seeking the vice presidential nomination at the Libertarian Party convention in Orlando, Florida. He wants to be the running mate of Gary Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico, who will head that ticket. So here's Weld speaking to CNN about his latest political adventure.
I think our purpose is to put in front of the country the fact that you can have an administration that's fiscally conservative and socially inclusive and see what the country thinks about that. I think that may be 40%+ of the country.
So, Tom, what do you think about Weld's latest jump into politics? And let's keep in mind that in 2012, Gary Johnson won 1% of the vote. Can he do better with
Weld? I don't think the Johnson-Weld ticket is going to be elected president. But I don't think that's the purpose. I mean, Scott Lehigh had a terrific piece in The Globe that really addressed it. And there's two related points here. One is that what you can do is perhaps try to deny either Trump or really it's out to get out. It's to go after Trump, of course, really try to deny Trump a majority of the Electoral College and thereby throw it into the House of Representatives, which would clearly not vote for Trump. Or it could simply be an attempt to pull voters away from Trump and thereby splitting the ticket so that Hillary has an easier time winning in states across the country. Yeah. But I think that's really the tactic that's going on here.
What do you see happening here, Renee?
I mean, it can certainly hurt Trump, but you never know. If you have those sort of center-right Democrats, they might kind of look at the Johnson-Weld ticket and go, oh, why not? I'm not voting for Donald Trump. I don't really care for Hillary Clinton. So it could actually hurt both of them. I'm not sure who it would hurt more.
Yeah, I think Fox News did a poll. If I have this right, I know somebody did a poll. I believe it was Fox News. And they actually showed that the Libertarians pulled slightly more from the Democrats than from the Republicans. I mean, that remains to be seen, but I was interested about that.
Well, in that case, it's like a Nader move.
Yeah, interesting. Well, respond to this. Here's Republican political consultant Jeff Stinson. I spoke to him here. He was very laudatory of Weld, calling him a great guy, a fantastic governor, but he didn't think much of this move. Here's what he said.
I think this sort of weakens his brand a little. He's always been known as a bridge builder for sure, but he's also been known as someone who sticks to his principles and someone who tends to toe the sort of moderate Republican line. And I think this kind of moves him into the sort of wackadoodle category, if you ask me.
What do you think? Fair, unfair?
Is that a political term, wackadoodle?
Wackadoodle category. Yeah.
So I'm gonna say unfair.
Okay.
Weld has always been more libertarian than anything else. If you go back and look at his record, that's really what he was all about. And I think he probably fits fairly comfortably into the Libertarian Party.
That's fair, yeah.
Particularly given what the Republican Party has become today.
Yeah. It doesn't hurt his brand at all.
Yeah,
I think it fits rather well with his brand.
Well, it's an interesting story. And again, our own Fred Tice is actually heading down to Orlando to cover the Libertarian presidential convention. So we're going to be hearing from that over the weekend and next Monday. So, Tom and Renee, that leaves us just enough time for our hubbubs, those brief stories that might not have made it to the top of the news but caught our attention. Renee, let me start with you.
Okay. This week, former Patriots linebacker Teddy Bruschi said that if the Golden State Warriors lose in the conference finals in the NBA, that they are worse, quote unquote, than the New England Patriots, who were the undefeated team that then lost to the New York Giants in the Super Bowl. I respect Teddy Bruschi. I love the fact that he loves his team, but look, that's not true. Your team lost to the Giants, who were 10-6 and were a wild card team? No. Whatever happens to Golden State, what happened to the Patriots losing in the Super Bowl is much, much worse.
He might have just been talking about statistics, right? Golden State is 73-9.
Irrelevant.
That's 89%.
It doesn't matter what you do. It's all about winning. And if Golden State loses, it's bad. But what happens to the Patriots, there's no question about it. It's immeasurably worse.
All right. Okay.
I'm also a Giants fan, just to put that in there.
Okay. Yeah. That should have been disclosed earlier.
Yes.
All right, Tom. How about you?
All right. So Boston Calling kicks off tonight. This three-day music festival, now in its fourth year, will attract throngs to City Hall Plaza. The festival, however, has been the subject of some controversy. The city's director of tourism, sports, and entertainment was just arrested last week on charges that he extorted organizers to force them to hire union labor. Undeterred, however, the organizers went forward. And even better, they've just announced a dramatic expansion of the event for 2017. That's going to involve moving to bigger grounds in Alston. And let's face it, half the attendees probably live in Alston anyway. The addition of a film festival and space enough to bring in truly big-name bands. City Hall, Simi Theatrics notwithstanding, the Bostic music scene is due for a welcome resurgence. And all I can say is, Coachella, here we come.
Okay, let's hear it for Boston Calling this weekend. I think we've got information on the artery about that, by the way, at WBUR.org. All right, here's my hubbub. You guys might have heard about this. Google has published a list of the hardest to spell words from all 50 states. So what they did was they searched the phrase, how to spell, and then the word in question. And they figured out the most troublesome word state by state. So here are a few. California, which is home to the Mojave Desert, apparently has trouble spelling the word desert. Not to be confused with dessert, I guess. Arizona and New Hampshire, they have trouble with the word diarrhea. Which is admittedly a difficult word. I like this one. New York searches most for the word beautiful. Who would have thought? Florida, tomorrow. Wyoming, ornery. And I'm going to ask you guys, my esteemed colleagues, for extra points today, what you think the word that Massachusetts has the most trouble spelling.
Massachusetts.
What do you think?
I go to Massachusetts as well.
You are correct. Ding, 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 ding. That's it. Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to the Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page here at WBUR. Tom, thanks. Have a great weekend.
You too.
And Renee Graham, columnist at the Boston Globe. Always great to have you, Renee. Thanks. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Anthony.
Stay with us. Coming up, a new play details the aftermath of the Boston Massacre in the old State House room where the meeting actually happened. Stick with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.